Hi, my name is Danielle, and you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. On this podcast, we discuss subjects that might be creepy to some and sometimes even frightening. Some of our episodes will deal with serious subject matter, while others will be more lighthearted. Please keep in mind that I am not an expert on any of the topics I cover, just an interested party, and as always, listener discretion is advised. Hi everyone and welcome back. I'm Danielle.
I'm Polybelle.
And you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. On this week's episode, we're going to discuss the case of a missing child. Today, we're going to be talking about the disappearance of Michelle Wedge. Michelle Wedge was 7.5 years old in the summer of 1975, according to a 2019 CBC News article. So schools would just have let out about 2 weeks prior. This was on July 2nd of 1975. The day after Canada Day in the Maritimes is almost like the kickoff to summer. I mean, our Maritime summers, June can be very spring-like for us. Kickoff for summer, kids are off from school finally. So you have the kids having those long, lazy evenings. This is the 1970s, so they've got pretty much free rein. I mean, in the 80s, growing up in the country, we had pretty much free rein of the, not the neighborhood, but the woods in the backyard and things like that. In the city, I know a lot of my friends, the rule was when the street lights come on, you go home. So that's probably kind of the atmosphere in their area where the kids were out playing until the street lights were on.
And it was a much smaller place than it is now back then also.
Right. So again, one of those situations where probably most people in the neighborhood knew exactly who everyone was. I don't think people were less aware of the danger necessarily in the 1970s, but I think, and especially in smaller places, there was very much a feeling of that doesn't happen here. Whereas now people tend to be much more aware of what goes on globally, so they tend to take less risks.
Yeah, I think people felt that it was, those types of crimes were from big cities. It didn't happen here.
Michelle and her family lived on Dominion Street in Moncton, New Brunswick. So on that evening of July 2nd, Michelle was being cared for by her older siblings. I don't have their ages here. I would assume they were probably teenagers, but early teens, late teens, I really don't know. Her sister had actually ended up going out for the evening, so her brother was still at home and was supposed to be keeping an eye on her, according to ucfiles.com. So she's being watched by her brother, and he has some friends come over. I'm assuming he's probably a little bit distracted, hanging out with his friends, not necessarily paying attention to your 7.5-year-old sister. And I'm not saying this to victim blame at all. The reason I'm saying it is because the times we're going to talk about might not be exact. So there are approximations from what he remembers. So he's hanging out with his friends and he believes that he heard Michelle step outside to ride her bike around 8:40 p.m. Michelle's sister got back home around 9 p.m., and it's at that time that they realize that the little girl was no longer around the house. So her siblings started searching for her, according to Canadian Crimepedia, but they weren't able to find her. I don't have any information on how quickly the police were alerted, or if the neighborhood started searching as well. I really don't have a lot of details on the case. And I actually found, and I'll talk about that a little bit later, but I found a recording of a police spokesperson being interviewed, and really they're not saying much about what happened. Everything is being played very close to the vest with this case, despite the fact that it happened in 1975. So her siblings aren't able to find her, but they did end up locating her bike, which, according to one article, was apparently secured near the intersection of Dominion and John Street. I take that to mean that the bike was either locked or propped up, like on the kickstand, not just kind of thrown in the middle of the street or anything like that. But then, according to other articles, they basically say that the bike was abandoned, was found abandoned. So I don't know if it's just a word play here.
And for people that are not familiar with the area, Dominion and John Street is still today mostly a residential area with all the two-story or multifamily homes. And there would have been even more so back then.
One of my friends, her parents lived on that street for one of those streets for a while. I think it was on John Street. And it's just like those older brick homes with the really big front porches. Houses are very close to the road. There's a lot of people around all the time because it's so residential. There's always people out on the street and walking around. But this was later in the evening, a little bit, 8:40 p.m. So probably a fair bit of people indoors at that point. And like I say, for the bike, we don't know exactly what state it was found in, but all the articles agree that it was found near that intersection of Dominion and John. Later on, a few witnesses would come forward stating that they had seen Michelle riding her bike in that area. Her bike is described as a Mustang-style bicycle. It's just one of those kids' bike with like the higher handlebars and the really long seats.
Was a popular bicycle back then because I remember having a Mustang bicycle and probably from around that same time. And they had what we call the banana seat and high rise handlebars.
Yeah, I remember having those my pink bike with the flowers on the banana seat when I was a kid too. They were quite popular. So a few witnesses came forward saying that they saw her riding her bike, and they said that this would have been around 9:10 p.m., so very shortly after her sister got home. The window between when she was seen and when they started looking must have been quite short. So I know the times may not be exact, but it does look like it's not a very long window. But more terrifying was that another witness remembers seeing her get into a car. And the description from the witness doesn't make it sound, so they're not saying she's being forced into a car or anything like that. Basically, it's just saying she was stepping into a vehicle. I found some information that I am going to repeat here, but please take it with a grain of salt because I believe that this information, though looked into by the police force, was later believed to maybe not have been quite accurate. There's two young girls that stated that they'd seen a man lure Michelle into a vehicle. They gave a description of him. They made up a composite sketch, and he was described as a male in his mid to late 20s with thick dark hair and dark glasses, who spoke with a strange voice and had a scar on his face. Apparently, the police actually found someone fitting this description, but nothing was ever pursued further, and it was implied in further articles that he may. Again, that description may have been something that, was, I'm not going to say made up, but that description may not have been accurate of the person who took Michelle. The car that was seen was described as a small dark green car with a black interior, and this is according to UCFiles.com. So even though there's information showing that Michelle may have gotten into a car, which sort of leads us to believe that this was a child abduction. But according to an RCMP spokesperson being interviewed on Information Morning, this was from 2 years ago, the case is actually not classified as an abduction case. She's just listed as a missing person. Again, I don't know if the reports about the car and the man seen in the area were disproven, or there was just no solid evidence showing that this had indeed happened, but again, they're not classifying it as an abduction, so I believe there must have been some reason that this eyewitness information that they got, they're not taking seriously. The spokesperson being interviewed on Information Morning did go on to state that it's still an open case and it's actually being investigated as a criminal investigation because they do believe that a person or people were involved in the disappearance. So I have a little bit of a hard time wrapping my head around them saying that it's not classified as an abduction, but they do think people were involved. I don't know the ins and outs of that, and the officer really did not give any detail as to why the classification landed like that. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, first of all, it's probably one of the more well-known cases in the area. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of rumors, even today, still flying around. And the police, you're right, are keeping things pretty close and pretty hush-hush. I suspect that they have a pretty good idea of who was involved, mm-hmm. but don't have the proof to lay any charges. But it's still a pretty hot topic, and you don't have to go very far to find somebody that claims to have information on the case that is not being made public.
Yeah, and I actually did read a few Reddit threads doing the same thing, which it's Reddit, so I'm not going to talk about that information. It's on the internet. Anyone can find it, but obviously there's nothing corroborating, and it's just anyone can write anything. But you're right, like this happened in 75, and if you bring it up to anyone whose family grew up in Moncton, who was in the Moncton area at the time, everybody still remembers this case. So the police officer being interviewed on Information Morning would not share why the case was considered a criminal investigation, other than, as I said before, saying that they believe someone else was involved in the disappearance. They stated that the last information they'd received about the case was approximately 7 years prior to the interview, so about 9 years ago. And the officer did go on to state, though, that a case like this would never be closed until it was solved, so it would always be considered an active case. The interview with the police officer felt, I don't know what the right word is, but almost every question that the interviewer was asking, the officer was reiterating that they couldn't speculate, they couldn't share any information. Like, that was pretty much the gist of the interview, being asked questions and the officer stating back that they couldn't say anything. They couldn't give any detail. Other than, again, repeating that they believed a person or people were involved, but nothing beyond that was really shared. She wouldn't even elaborate on how often the police were in contact with Michelle's family. There's really no new information that was shared. Now, we discuss it pretty frequently on this podcast about how frustrating it can feel sometimes when the police don't share information with the public. And for the most part, they generally have good reasons for doing so, but it's just really hard when it's those cases that have been unsolved for so long. You wonder, maybe if you just released a little bit more that someone could come forward, but they might not have anything they can say without, you know, pointing the finger directly at someone.
I think also that New Brunswick is not that big of an area. So it's easy to find somebody that's related to Michelle, mm-hmm. in the area. And it's easy to find somebody that's related to somebody that may be a suspect in the case or had been interviewed. We're so closely connected in this area that it's really difficult. So I can understand the police being hush-hush about things and not wanting to make anything public until they can actually lay charges or solve the case.
Actually, I did see a blog discussing some similarities between Michelle's disappearance and the disappearance of a 5-year-old girl from St. John, New Brunswick. Her name was Shirley Milberry, which happened a few years prior. I can't really talk much about that other than to say I saw mention of it. There's nothing I could find other than a few Facebook posts on Shirley Milberry and her disappearance, and there were no sources, so I don't know if that information's accurate, though it does look like a 5-year-old girl went missing in St. John, and
And St. John is 90 minutes from Moncton.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not that far of a distance. So there may be some connection, or it may just be a coincidence. But I'm sure that if you're able to find some information on it at some point, the police would have looked into that too.
I'm certain they would have as well, and there might be reasons not to see them. I mean, they may not be connected at all, right? At the time of her disappearance, Michelle was wearing a red and white checkered t-shirt, blue shorts, blue socks, and navy blue sandals, which were size 3. When she disappeared, she was 4 feet tall with brown eyes and light brown hair that I also saw described as dark blonde, and she had a fair complexion, according to the Doe Network website. I think one important thing to take away from this is Michelle's case is not forgotten. It's still very active in people's minds, and it's still active in the police force's mind. They still want to solve this case. And you mentioned that a lot of people think they know information, and it's possibly just rumors and things like that. But if anyone listening knows anyone or has any information, please contact the RCMP or Crime Stoppers. You might think they know something that they're not aware of, that the public hasn't come forward with. So if you have anything at all on this case, you can contact the Kodiak RCMP at 506-857-2494 or Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-8477.
And just to add to that, if people think they may know something and they call it in and let the police decide if it's important information or not. So, you know, how little you know, don't base your decision on that. Just if you think you know something, call them and the police will make the decision on whether it's something that needs to be followed up.
Right, don't assume they have this knowledge. Before we finish up with our moment of kindness, I have a little announcement to make. We're going to be taking the rest of the summer off from the podcast. I've been thinking about this long and hard. It's not really something I wanted to do. I do enjoy recording these episodes and putting them out weekly, but I seem to have fallen behind with life a little bit lately. And after the COVID shutdown, I also want to make sure I have time to visit family and friends and I'm not rushing home to record or to edit. It might not seem like a lot of work, but it definitely takes at least 6 to 10 hours a week to get one episode together. So we should be back in your feeds the first Sunday of September. I thank everyone in advance for their understanding. So it's just going to be a brief hiatus and we'll be back early September.
I think it's important for everybody to relearn how to live and to have a little bit of freedom to travel. We get out of the habit real fast, and there's always the danger of becoming hermits. So I think I'd encourage people to get out and do the things they haven't been able to do and reach out to the people they haven't been able to see and enjoy their summer.
For sure, yeah. So it'll just be, I mean, it's like 5 or 6 weeks that we're going to be taking off, and then we'll be back.
And I'll keep things going with the occasional post on Facebook just to keep people engaged.
Right, and by all means, reach out through Facebook, email, Instagram. We're still going to be around. We're still going to be checking that stuff. We will probably still be working during those weeks to try and get a few episodes together so we have some content ready for quality episodes when we get back in the fall. So let's finish up with our moment of kindness. Two people that are very important to us undertook a challenge recently to help their local First Nations community. They decided they were going to run 13.9 kilometers for 10 consecutive days. So this would amount to 1 kilometer for each residential school that there was in Canada, which helped add names on a memorial for residential school survivors. So they worked really hard over 10 days to achieve that goal. They ran in all sorts of weather. There was heat, there was drenching rain, there was wind, everything. And They did it faithfully every single day. I'm very proud of them for going through with this and being able to make the donation. And I think we're at a point where all of us are kind of trying to figure out what we can do to honor both the survivors and those who did not survive residential schools. It's something that's in the news almost every day, and I think it's all in our heads and in our hearts right now. So I want to congratulate Michelle and Eric for finding a way to do this and for challenging themselves and others to make donations. I'm very proud of them both.
I am too. And just for the people that don't know, Michelle and Eric are your sister and brother, and my daughter and son.
Your other children.
My other children. And as a follow-up to that, the last 13.9 kilometers they ran in the community of El Cibucto, is where they did their run. And they were very well received by the people of the community. I walked the last mile with them to the memorial, and people were driving by and blowing their horns, and people were stopping and making donations while they were running. So it was a really good feeling to see that.
Yes, and I think that's the thing we have to, I know not everyone's in a position to donate money. If you drive by, you know, someone in an orange shirt, because there were people doing a walk here in Nova Scotia as well, you know, blow your horn, wave, show your support, reach out to your local communities, see if there's any volunteer work that can be done. I think you're right, we have to find ways to heal. We have to find ways to show that we want to be allies. So whatever little bit we can do. So thanks to everyone who's been listening. I do really appreciate all the downloads, all the comments and the listens. It's really great when you reach out to us. We very much appreciate it. As I mentioned, we'll be off air for a little bit, but we'll be back at the beginning of September. Please feel free to reach out through Facebook. You can just search our Facebook group, which is Crime and Mystery Canada. We're on Instagram under the same name, and our email address is crimeandmysterycanada@gmail.com. I hope everyone stays safe out there, have a really great summer, and a good night.
Good night. Enjoy life. Stay safe.